My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure, after many years, of interviewing Ruth Ozeki. The title of your latest book out in paperback is A Tale for the Time Being. On the Man Booker Prize list. That's yes. Very impressive. And it's published by Penguin. It's been, we decided, what, about 18 years since we've seen each other?
I think it was 1998, so it's 98. Not quite that bad. Yeah, about 15 long. Years, yeah. Something like
okay.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, my arithmetic skills are never very good. This book, A Tale for the Time Being, when I got the book, I said, oh, good, Ruth, I haven't spoken to Ruth in a long time. And then I started reading the book, and it occurred to me after a while, and it occurred to me only yesterday, what was really going on in this book. This is a book of ideas in the form of a popular novel.
Oh, God, I've been so busted.
But yes, here's the revelation I had yesterday, that in fact, this book is a Zen koan. The book is an insoluble riddle. Yeah. That makes you meditate on it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Totally busted. Okay. Now we have nothing else to say for the rest of the interview.
No, actually we do. because you do a lot of really cool, clever things in here. Yeah. For example, there are two main voices in this book. One is a woman named Ruth, who's remarkably like you.
Very similar. It's such a coincidence. I don't know. Yeah.
Lives in the same place you do, has a husband with the same name.
We share the same husband, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a cat named Pesto?
I changed the cat's name.
Oh, well, because the cat would be PO'd otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Tell us a little bit about the island you live in, near Vancouver Island.
Well, in reality, not in the book, but in reality, I live on an island called Cortez Island, which is up in Desolation Sound in the northern Gulf Islands. Yeah. So it's about... you know, by car and three ferries, about 8 hours from Vancouver.
Wow.
Yeah.
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 So
it's remote.
Fantastic.
It's,
yes, it is remote. Now, part of the plot is put in motion here, the MacGuffin here, is that Ruth, the character, is walking on the beach and finds a plastic bag.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about this?
Sure. She's walking on the beach and she finds this plastic bag that's kind of encrusted with barnacles tangled up in bull kelp. And, you know, she doesn't know what it is, but it's, you know, debris on the beach. And so she, you know, takes it home, you know, to throw it out, right? But what she leaves it on the porch, and her husband, Oliver, discovers it there. And he looks inside and he finds a Hello Kitty lunchbox. And inside the Hello Kitty lunchbox, you know, I mean, he's very carefully kind of forensically unpeeling all of this, these layers. Inside the Hello Kitty lunchbox, he finds a bunch of letters, a book, a mysterious book, an old book, and also a wristwatch. And the title of the book is À la recherche du temps perdu. So it's Proust's In Search of Lost Time. And so they're, you know, inspecting all of these odd things in the lunchbox. And Ruth opens up the book and sees that the inside has been hacked and it's been turned into a diary. And the diary belongs to this young girl named Nao Yasutani, who lives in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. Now, her real name is it Naoko? Is
that Naoko, how? Yeah.
Yeah, right. and but it's shortened to Nao.
That's right.
And, of course, Nao is also the homonym in English.
Yes, that's right.
It has something to do with time.
Yes.
A tale for the time being, time being, again, has many levels of meaning because it means the time being, you know, for the time the story takes place. Yeah. But it's also a creature that exists in time, in the jello of time.
Exactly, exactly. No, there was something about that phrase, time being, that is, it's elusive and it's unstable because depending on how you inflect it, its meaning can change in very interesting ways. And I really like that. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like our, you know, it's like our experience of time, which is also kind of elusive and unstable, you know. So, you know, you can either pronounce it time being or time being, right? And it comes from, you know, I was doing some research and studying some Zen philosophy texts. And you mentioned earlier that this is kind of like a Zen koan. And I think that was the inspiration for the book. But I was reading the essays by a Zen master, 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji. And he wrote a book, an essay, called Uji in Japanese. And Uji can be translated as being time or time being or for the time being. And so that, you know, phrase kind of lodged in my mind and, you know, little by little kind of, you know, mixed up with other things in my mind and kind of emerged as a novel.
Do you know Kurt Vonnegut's Twelve Amadorians?
Oh, yeah.
You know about their concept of time?
Oh, I forgot.
It's a series of mountain peaks, and you're standing on one mountain peak, but you could just as easily leap to another mountain peak and be in another time. And as I read this book, I kept thinking about that Western conceptions of time are all linear.
Yeah.
But not everybody's conception of time is linear.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. That's nice to remember.
Let's talk a bit about now. Let me set it up first, mm-hmm. because when Ruth finds the diary, she starts devouring it because she's interested in it in many ways. And it's pretty contemporary. She doesn't really know how long ago the thing was written. Mm-hmm. But the kid is using fairly current slang, mm-hmm. and talking about fairly current music and things like that. She's about 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And at some point, she decides that it's a bad idea just to devour the diary, but mm-hmm. she's going to read it the way it was written. Tell us about why she decides to do that.
Well, you know, Ruth is a strange character. But in any case, she's just decided that, you know, she's a novelist too. She's a writer too. And she's decided that she wants to read the diary at the same rate that Now has written it, that the girl has written it, so as to better get a sense of the girl's, you know, of the pace of the girl's lived life. Right. And so she purposefully slows her reading down, right, in order to do this. And in a way, she's just kind of playing, but also she's really trying to understand what is going on with this girl's life. Now, I should also mention that Ruth finds the diary in the wake of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. So she thinks that the Hello Kitty lunchbox with the diary, you know, is part of the debris field that's, you know, been floating over, you know, to our coastline ever since March 11th, 2011. And so she's, you know, Ruth is very concerned about the fate of this girl. She wants to know, she wants to find out, you know, what happened to Now? Did she survive? Why is, you know, how did the diary, you know, end up in the ocean? But at the same time, she feels that her investigation would be, you know, would be helped by slowing down rather than speeding up. So, yeah.
There's two things about this book that gave me a bit of pause before I started talking to you. One is that whenever I have a mystery novelist come in here, I always tell them before we go on, now, look, if I tread too heavily on the plot and there's something you don't want me to talk about, just tell me to back off.
Yeah.
I want you to do the same thing.
Okay.
The other thing is that this book is such a tapestry. There's so much in it that one is tempted. I'm tempted to get into the minutiae, and I don't want to just make this interview about the minutiae because there's so much of it. It's a cultural soup of Western thought and Zen thought and modern American and Japanese culture, and you tend to take somewhat of a dim view of the cultural history of Japan in this. In fact, you're pretty hard on that whole World War II Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, you know, I think I'm pretty hard on any, you know, wartime culture. You know, any bellicose imperialist country, I think I would be probably pretty harsh with, you know. So Japan had some pretty, you know, has a pretty bad record during World War II, and so the book, you know, A Tale for the Time Being, certainly, you know, draws on some of that historical record. I think one of the things too that always annoys me is the fact that Japan is trying to rewrite its history books. There's a large faction of you know, people in Japan who would really like to write those atrocities out of history, and so that, of course, I find unconscionable. But, you know, the other thing, though, and in this book, I think, you know, you'll find as well, the you know, there are certain aspects of World War II history that have already dropped out, right? And so what the book takes up is the diaries and letters of one of the characters in the book. Haruki number one, who was a kamikaze pilot. And so one of the things that I was, you know, very interested in were the diaries and letters and writings of the student soldiers who were drafted into the Japanese army and, you know, against their will, sent to fight in the suicide squadrons. And this is something that you just never hear about in you know, it's a piece of history that's kind of disappeared. And certainly it was something that I'd never known about until I stumbled across some books by an anthropologist at University of Wisconsin and read about this and was deeply moved by it. I mean, these boys who were sent to fight in these, you know, in the kamikaze were, you know, were very well educated, very thoughtful, you know, poets and philosophers, and you know, they were doing this. It was, you know, a draft situation so that, you know, they didn't have a choice. And, you know, they were not the kind of fundamentalist, fanatic imperialists that, you know, that we've been taught that they, you know, that they were. So any case, I mean, I think that, you know, it was more to kind of fill in some of the holes in history that, you know, that I was drawn to the subject.
Yeah, there is, however, like in most countries, including the one we're standing in right now, mm-hmm. there's a strong current of native fascism, like, for want of a better terminology. That's probably not the best terminology to use, but Yukio Mishima, the Japanese novelist, he worshipped at that shrine up until the day he died, which I believe was in the 60s or 70s, and he was still believed that the imperialist Japan was the Japan that he loved, and he served it.
Yeah.
But I need to set this up. Now, in her darker moments, thinks that her family's two of her family's major traits are philosophy and a tendency to suicide.
That's right. That's
yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
She has a 104-year-old great-grandmother named Jiko.
Yeah.
Jiko's son was Haruki number one, who was the kamikaze pilot, and his nephew, Haruki number two, is Nao's father.
That's right.
Have I gotten that
that's right.
lineage?
Perfect.
Yeah, okay.
Perfect. Yeah.
Tell us about Sunnyvale, what happened in Sunnyvale, without going too deeply into it. Of course, you can't do that. But and how now winds up in Japan.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to be doing that for the whole interview.
I know. So, you know, Ruth is reading the diary, and what she discovers is that now this girl is living in Japan, you know, is living in Japan when she was writing the diary, but prior to that she had grown up in Sunnyvale, California. Her father was a computer programmer and had been hired by a tech firm in Silicon Valley, and he had moved the family over to Sunnyvale when Nao was only 3 years old. And so Nao grew up in the U.S. She, you know, and she really thought of herself more as an American child. When she was a teenager, when the dot-com bubble burst, the father loses his job as well as the family savings and is forced to bring the family back to Tokyo. And now, you know, is put back into a junior high school in Tokyo. She doesn't have, you know, the language skills, the cultural familiarity, and she doesn't have a lot of money to buy nice stuff. And so she's put into a situation where she's really a fish out of water, and she's being very badly bullied. As a result of the bullying, she's decided that she's going to end her life. But before she does end her life, she wants to do one last act of redemption, and that is to write the life story of her great-grandmother, Old Jiko, who is a 104-year-old Zen Buddhist nun. And Old Jiko is probably the only reliable adult in Nao's life. And so Nao, you know, has decided that, you know, that she's going to write the Old Jiko's life story and then end her life. But of course, you know, she's 16 years old, and so she gets, you know, sublimely distracted by her own life and never quite gets around to telling Old Jiko's life story.
Yes, but we get a bit of it through her. And in fact, one summer, her father decides that the best thing to do for this poor daughter of his, who's really not having a very good life, is to take her up to the temple which Jiko lives, and leaving her there for the summer, not abandoning her, although he really can't cope. And she has a mother. Her mother's actually has a job, but daddy's home all the time because he can't get work, and he's depressed. He thinks that leaving her with Jiko will actually help.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I think it does, because Jiko really is the only, you know, she's 104 years old, but, you know, she has a I think, a very stabilizing and grounding influence on her great-granddaughter. And Nao really loves it at the temple. And, you know, at first she's resistant to the idea, but, you know, she soon, you know, finds a lot of reassurance, you know, in the temple lifestyle. And Old Jiko also has decided that Nao needs, you know, she needs some coping skills, some coping strategies. And so she's taught Nao how to sit zazen, how to sit you know, Zen meditation. She calls it her superpower. Right.
Except, superpower.
Right. She doesn't speak English very well, so she actually pronounces it superpower.
So. Very good. I like that. I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Ruth Ozeki. Her last name is spelled O-Z-E-K-I. The title of her book is A Tale for the Time Being, published by Penguin. This bullying horrified me. I mean, we all know about bullying in American schools, and we all know, but this takes on a particularly nasty turn, especially when a substitute teacher joins in. Does that stuff really happen?
Well, I don't know whether it happens. I wouldn't say that it would happen routinely, but I did base it on a story that I read in the newspaper. So, yeah, you know, I mean, most of the, I would say all of the episodes, you know, of you know, the kind of bullying games that the kids were playing and the incidents, you know, without getting into great detail about it, they were all based on accounts that I'd read in newspapers and online.
Well, we could probably say that she's poked and pinched to the extent that she has little scars from being cut with nail scissors
That's right.
I mean, she's a mess, this
kid. She's been pretty badly, you know, beaten up. Yeah.
Okay, now her father, Haruki number two, has attempted at least once to commit suicide and hasn't done very well at that either.
No,
you know, he's apparently inept even at killing himself. Yeah. You want to tell us about the train thing?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little unclear as to whether he was drunk and fell on the tracks or whether he actually threw himself in front of a train. But in any case, you know, the train wasn't really moving very fast when it, you know, was in a station, and so he survived unscathed. So he's, you know, it's hard to know what his motives were. But in any case, he has, you know, he's had some close calls like this. And after a couple of them, you know, now has decided that, in fact, yes, he is trying to commit suicide. And you know, if he's going to do it, then she will, too. And, you know, it's interesting about now because, you know, she's the author of her diary. Right. And in a way, even though all these terrible things are happening to her, she finds a way of gaining control and understanding over her circumstances through the act of writing. And in a way, it's almost as if she's learning to survive by writing. And it reminded me as I was writing the story of a kind of a Scheherazade type of, you know, story where, you know, as long as this girl can continue narrating her life, as long as she can continue, you know, writing about herself and about what's going on, then she'll be okay. So there's that kind of resilience in her character too that I think that any writer understands, because in a way that's kind of what we do.
I always said that writing was the cheapest form of psychotherapy.
Yeah, right.
You can work out so much just by putting it down on a page.
That's right.
I want to talk about Jiko. Jiko is 104 years old and has lived through a lot. And I learned, I presume, this book is footnoted extensively.
Yes, that's right.
Japanese words are footnoted in it, and concepts are footnoted in it, and little bits of history, like the Taisho democracy, which I had no idea about. But she, Jiko, in her youth, was a radical in Japan during a brief period of democracy before the Tojo thing came in. Yeah. And she was a fan, an acolyte of Emma Goldman.
Yeah, that's right.
Which made me laugh because Emma Goldman and Rosa Luxemburg are two of my heroes. So I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But she, tell us a little bit about the Taisho democracy and also about the I novel.
Mm, okay. Well, the Taisho democracy only lasted for about 12 years and I think concluded around 1926 or something. I'm a little vague on dates, but I think that's about right. It was a very, very short period of time. You know, it was a period of liberalism that flourished in between the Between the Meiji period and then the period leading up to World War II. Mm-hmm. So it was this very brief period of democracy when the women's movement really, you know, became quite strong in Japan. And so there was there were several groups of women writers who were operating at the time. They were publishing magazines. They were writing like crazy.
And, the equivalent of the Blue Stockings.
The Blue Stockings. Actually, that's exactly what their name was. They took the name in Japanese, Seitosha, which literally means Blue Stocking Society. And so it was this very, very interesting period for women. And, you know, Jiko, that was, you know, Jiko's background. That was where she, you know, that was her time period, and that's when she was writing herself. And she, another thing that was popular right around this time was something called the, in Japanese, watakushi shosetsu, or literally, I novel. Right.
Watakushi
means
I, the,
I. Right.
Yeah, the personal,
personal pronoun I. That's right. So these were autobiographical novels that were written at the time, and you know they became very popular. And I mean, you can still see them. I mean, in a way, you could say that Haruki Murakami writes a form of I novel. Right. So it's a kind of an autobiographical fiction that. More or less, you know, where the protagonist, you know, more or less resembled the, you know, the character of the author. And so this was a kind of a conceit that I was playing with in the novel, in A Tale for the Time Being as well.
Everything in this book is about time. Mm-hmm. The fact that the diary was written in a hollowed out, they're just the covers left of Recherche de Temps Perdu, a book by the... I got through Swan's Way and decided that when I have a wasting disease, I'll finish reading it just like he wrote it while he had a wasting disease.
That's right. That's
right. Yeah, it's a bit much to get through. But everything about this book is about time lost, time regained, because the Ruth's mother has Alzheimer's in
the
book.
That's right.
And I kept thinking, is Alzheimer's being in the eternal present? Is it being in the eternal past? What exactly, how does the time manifest itself in Alzheimer's? And it's, in a way, another metaphor for what goes on in the book.
Exactly, exactly. No, that's exactly right. Yeah, Ruth's mother in the book and also my mother in real life had Alzheimer's. And while I was taking care of my mother, I was watching her. And, you know, it was very interesting because, you know, at some point, time becomes kind of irrelevant. You know, it doesn't really matter whether it's, you know, 3 in the afternoon or 3 at night. It doesn't really matter whether it's Tuesday or Saturday. You know, these concepts are you know, quite irrelevant. And as long as, you know, when you're caretaking, you know, somebody with Alzheimer's, you know, if I started to insist, no, Mom, it's Tuesday, you know, that would get her all upset, you know, because she couldn't remember. And what's the point of that? So it became clear to me that it really didn't matter. She was right. It didn't matter at all whether it was Tuesday or Saturday.
Right. It's eternal now.
Exactly. So you just kind of let go of all of that. And that's, you know, that's very nice and it's very Buddhist. And, but the other thing too is that, you know, when you're, you know, anybody who has taken somebody with Alzheimer's understands this, but you're really watching somebody drop out of time, you know, little by little, you know, my mother didn't remember the things that happened yesterday, but she would remember something that happened, you know, when she was a child. But, you know, little by little, those older memories start to erode too. And, you know, and so it's, you know, you really are sort of watching somebody slowly, you know, just drop out of time.
This is probably the most terrifying thing for any sentient human being is to think that the thing that they are, the pot of memory and the pot of knowledge slowly starts to go away.
Yeah.
And what is left, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty scary stuff.
It is scary stuff. It is scary stuff. And you know, and it's sad to, you know, to watch that happen. At the same time though, you know, it makes you wonder. It really does make you think about these things. You know, it's, are we our memories? Is that really what's important? You know, with my mom, you know, I think that she was great because she didn't really cling to things. She was pretty sanguine about just letting things go and, you know, being in the moment. And so it was such a wonderful lesson, you know, for me to watch her and to watch the way she was so kind of gracious about just letting stuff go. You know, a lot of people aren't like that. I hope that, you know, I hope that if you know, this should happen to me, that I will, you know, I will remember my mother's, you know, way of doing it and be able to, you know, to do that, you know, to let go that easily too.
Oh, well, it's nice to be graceful about it because, because one hopes one will be.
Yeah.
That kind of leads me, it slides right into the next thing I was going to talk about is when Nao and Jiko are together at the temple, the thing that Jiko understands that Nao kind of knows but really can't absorb yet is that you shouldn't sweat the small stuff and it's all small stuff.
Right.
Is that basically what Jiko's philosophy is? Because, I mean, she has gone into to become a Buddhist nun for a reason herself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. She's had some pretty terrible experiences in her own life during the war. Well, you know, I think that when you're 104 years old, you have a different perspective, you know.
On one hopes.
On time, you know, and on what's important, you know. And I think that certainly the older we get, you know, the more we realize that everything changes, that nothing, you know, nothing remains the same, that things that seem so tremendous and insurmountable at one moment will vanish in the next. So Jiko certainly has this, you know, has a kind of a longer temporal perspective than her 16-year-old daughter.
Yeah, I think Buddhists generally do.
Great-granddaughter.
Yeah. One of the things about this book that I liked is that it conflates Zen principles with quantum mechanics. Now, you know, I'm sure there's eyes rolling and people listening to this right now are saying, oh my God. But there's a certain similarity in the way each depicts the universe. And again, being and not being are, you know, are part of quantum mechanics. And also one of the tenets of Zen is that we're here, we're not here, it's all the same thing. How did you decide to do that? What made you make that one-to-one correspondence?
You know, I'm not, I don't really remember exactly why I decided to kind of move in the direction of quantum mechanics. But it, put it this way, it's certainly something like, for example, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics is something that I think all writers, and particularly fiction writers, we have a kind of an intuitive understanding of that as metaphor. And I'm certainly not the only writer by any means who's been, you know, who's been intrigued by this. I mean, there are many who, you know, pay homage to this as a, you know, as a kind of a literary trope. But in this case, with this book, there are certain ways that I've tried to take things like, for example, the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment and run that vocabulary throughout the book. And, you know, the book is very much playing with Zen concepts like impermanence, for example, or interconnectedness, or self, no self. You know, these are certain kinds of Zen propositions that the book takes up and, in a way, performs. And there are corollaries to certain, you know, quantum, what, I've lost the word here, phenomena.
Okay.
That I found very interesting. And so, you know, that was something that I wanted to explore, you know, both from the Zen aspect as well as from the, you know, the quantum aspect. So I ended up having to consult with several astrophysicists and people who, because I didn't want to use it just simply as a metaphorical device. I wanted to actually have that the quantum phenomena sort of interpenetrate more, you know, more deeply with the plot of the book and the kinds of things that are occurring in the book. It's very hard to talk about this without giving things away.
I can't
give you specific examples.
I want people to be intrigued. Yeah.
But so, for example, Ruth's cat, Pesto, you know, in the book, both, you know, there's a point in the book where the cat both is and isn't, right? Which is, of course, a reference to Schrodinger.
Yeah. That's the kind of thing that made Einstein say, God does not play dice with the universe.
That's right. And he also talked about, what was it? Spooky. God, there's this wonderful Einstein quote.
Neither of us is going to remember.
Okay,
yeah. There's also, and I found this illuminating because as we were talking before we started the interview, that when I was in high school in the 50s, I thought of myself as a, you know, knowing something about Zen, and I could sit in a lotus position and do all that stuff, but I knew nothing. You know, I knew nothing. I knew what Gary Snyder told me, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Well, that's considerable.
So. I suppose it's more than the average person.
But
this book has a kind of a primer on Zen principles, and I've read about you that you are a Zen priest. So this is was a labor of love in that sense as well?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, the book, I think, very much grew out of, you know, the Zen practice and the Zen study that I've been doing for the past, you know, 15 years or something like that. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I'd been reading Dogen Zenji, the 13th century Zen master, and you know, the book was very much a kind of playing with or an interpretation of you know, some of Dogen's teachings. And probably other things as well. I really was thinking of it as a kind of a performance of Zen propositions. Rather than, you know, I mean, you can write about these things, or you could try to, you know, make them come alive on the page. So that's kind of more what I was trying to do.
This just came to me. There's a lot of irony in the book.
Yes.
But it seems to me that Zen is like duality without irony. Is that a fair statement?
That's interesting. I have to think about that. I like that.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. So you've in effect juxtaposed these two things again in this book, you know, consciously or not. Kinky Friedman once told me that people are always finding things in his books that he didn't put in there. So,
and if he, I mean, I always take credit for those things.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. Yeah, you should always take credit for that. Yeah. It's always so much fun to talk to you. It's so much fun to see you again. I've been speaking with Ruth Ozeki. Again, her name is spelled O-Z-E-K-I. The title of her book, which was on the Man Booker Prize finalist list, very impressive, A Tale for the Time Being. It's published by Penguin. I sure hope you come back again sooner than 18 or 15 years.
That I'll do my best.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.